felt him jerk her wrists behind her back and bind them together with a zip tie. "Quit fighting me, sweetheart," the man whispered into Letty's ear. "It's over. You're done." 16. The noise of the powerboat engines was deafening. Letty's hair whipped across her face, but she couldn't brush it away with her hands still bound behind her back. James was at the controls, and she sat in the bucket seat behind him, next to the man who'd taken her down. He was the oldest of Fitch's security crew, 45 or 50, with shoulder-length hair the color of dishwater. The sun wasn't up yet, but the first light of dawn had begun to color the eastern sky. Letty's underwear rippled in the fierce wind. She shivered, waiting for the engines to go silent, dreading it. Of all the ways to die, considering her past, she feared drowning more than anything. Would they tie something around her to weigh her down, then just throw her over the side? She would beg for a bullet when the time came. And if they don't oblige you? They would have to. She'd do whatever it took. She couldn't allow herself to be tossed overboard while still alive. Couldn't spend her last 3 minutes sinking into the cold, dark sea, fighting that terrible thirst for oxygen as it swelled up inside her lungs, meeting the same death her daddy had almost given her. The panic grew. She could feel herself beginning to come apart at the seams. And then, lights shone in the distance. James throttled down as they approached the marina. He guided the boat into an open slip and killed the engines. He got up and faced Letty.
"Stand up," he told her.
She stood. The man beside her pulled out a folding knife and cut her wrists free. James reached into the co-pilot seat and grabbed a wad of clothes. He handed them to Letty.
"You're letting me go," she said.
James nodded.
"But you let me believe you were going to..."
"You tried to kill me, Ms. Dobesh. My shoulder is still burning. If I were you, I would put those clothes on right now and get the hell out of my boat."
Letty moved through the lobby of the La Concha Hotel. Despite the wreck she must have looked, the concierge still smiled and nodded as she stumbled past. She wasn't drunk anymore, just tired to the point that nothing seemed real. Not the planted palm trees or the chandeliers, not the eerie quiet of 5 a.m., not even her own reflection in the elevator doors as she rode up to her room. She drifted down the corridor like a vagabond, old pair of flip-flops, boxer shorts, a Jimmy Buffett t-shirt from Fitch's closet that had faded into oblivion. She couldn't even think about the last 10 hours. They were beyond processing. Morning was almost here. She had no money, no idea how she would get back to the mainland. But one thought kept needling her. Javier. The strangest thing was that his betrayal didn't just make her angry, it hurt her, too. It wasn't like he was a friend. She couldn't fathom that Hav was even remotely capable of experiencing the feelings required to maintain a friendship. And yet, it hurt. They had worked together twice before. Both jobs had been successful. So why had he done this to her? She shoved her key card 4 times into the slot before the light on the door blinked green. "Because he's a psychopath, Letty. He had a need. You filled it. End of story." She kicked off the flip-flops and staggered toward the bed. Smelled his exotic cologne a half second before she noticed Javier sitting at the small table by the window. She brought her hand to her mouth. The door whisked closed behind her. In a night of being chased and shot at, none of those horrors could touch the sheer terror of seeing Javier Estrada sitting like a demon in her hotel room. She stood frozen, wondering if she could get out the door before he stopped her.
"You wouldn't make it," he said. "Please."
He motioned to the bed.
"I'm sure you're very tired."
Letty sat down on the edge of the mattress and put her face in her hands. She said, "Oh, God." So many times tonight she had thought she was going to die and hadn't. Now this. After everything, it was too much.
"What do you want to ask me?"
he said. She made no response.
"Nothing? How about, am I surprised that you are not dead?"
"You son of a bitch," she muttered it under her breath.
"Ask me,"
he said. She glared over at him.
Are you surprised I'm not dead?
I am not, he said.
Good for you. Her eyes were filling up with tears. Good for you. Why didn't you just let Fitch's men kill me? Wanted to clean up this last little detail yourself?
I like you, Letty.
Has anyone ever told you you're deranged?
Javier opened a laptop sitting on the table beside a slim-lined Glock. He said,
You may choose to believe I betrayed you. I don't see it that way.
Really?
He began typing, still watching her out of the corner of his eye.
There were reasons I couldn't tell you the nature of the job. It partly had to do with promises I made to our client, Mr. Fitch, but some of it just came down to my faith in you.
He stared at her.
2 times before this, we worked together. I've seen you in action. Simply put, you're a survivor. I believed you would survive tonight.
You had no right to,
and yet I did.
Next topic.
Part of my agreement with Mr. Fitch was that if you survived, if you killed him, his men were not to touch you. I went so far as to promise him that if anyone other than him laid a hand on you, I would kill his men and his sons too. Was a hand laid upon you?
Why didn't you just let me in on this?
Because you might have said no. Come over here. I want to show you something.
Letty pushed against her knees and stood. Already her legs had gone stiff. 3 feet away, she stopped.
What?
She asked. Javier was pointing at the laptop.
Do you see this?
She leaned over his shoulder, squinting at the screen. It was an accounts page on a website for the First National Bank of Nassau.
What's this supposed to be?
Letty asked.
It's an account I opened for you. Do you see this?
Javier was pointing at a number. $1 million.
Is that?
Yes, that's your balance. Do you remember the first thing I asked you when we met back in Atlanta?
You asked if I'd risk my life for a $1 million payday.
And do you recall?
I said yes.
You said yes. I know I said $4 million, but I wasn't even paid for this job. I'm giving you 50%. You earned it.
Javier stood. He stared down at her through those alien blue eyes.
You know to keep your mouth shut about Fitch.
Letty nodded. Javier lifted his Glock and jammed it into the back of his waistband. He picked up his leather jacket, slid his arms carefully into the sleeves.
Why are you giving this to me?
Letty asked.
Who can say? Maybe we'll work together again.
You still sold me out.
You'll get over it. Or you won't.
He walked out. Letty sat at the table and stared at the computer screen for a long time. She couldn't take her eyes off that number. Light was coming into the sky. The lamps along Duval Street were winking off. She couldn't imagine falling asleep now. Letty raided the minibar and stocked her purse, headed out still wearing John Fitch's clothes. The roof of the hotel was vacant, the bar closed. Letty eased down into one of the east-facing deck chairs, drank cheap champagne, watched the sun lift out of the sea. Something Hav had said kept banging around inside her head. It'll buy you enough crystal to kill yourself 1,000 times over. Already she was feeling the itch to score, a pure craving. Is that what lay in store? 3 months from now, would she be living out of another motel, 90 pounds and wasting away? Now that she had enough money to finish the job, would she use until her teeth melted and her brain turned to mush? Until her heart finally exploded? She told herself that wasn't going to happen, that she wouldn't lose control again, but she didn't know if she believed it. The sun climbed. Soon there were other people on the roof, and the smell of mimosas and Bloody Marys was in the air. Letty ordered breakfast. As the morning grew warm, she thought about her son. In better times, mostly while high, she imagined sweeping back into Jacob's life, saw them in parks, parent-teacher conferences, tucking him into bed at night after a story. But she didn't want to entertain those fantasies now. She wasn't fit, had nothing to offer him. She couldn't get the hotel concierge out of her mind. She wondered if he could assist on scoring her a teener and a pipe. 3 times she started down to the lobby. 3 times she stopped herself.
It was the memory of the Atlanta motel that kept turning her back, the image of her skeletal reflection in that cracked mirror, the idea of someone someday having to tell her son how his mother had OD'd when he was 6 years old. In the afternoon, Letty moved to the other side of the roof. She passed in and out of sleep as the sun dropped. In her waking moments, she tried on 3 promises to herself, just to see how they fit. I will set up a trust fund for Jacob with half the money and make it so I can never touch it. I will check myself into the best rehab program I can find. If I'm still clean a year from now, then, and only then, will I go to my son. The next time she woke, there were people all around her, and the sun was halfway into the ocean. Letty sat up, came slowly to her feet. She walked over to the edge of the roof. The people around her were making toasts to the sunset and to each other. Nearby, a woman mentioned a news report concerning the death of John Fitch. The group laughed, someone speculating that the coward had taken his own life. Letty clutched the railing. She couldn't escape the idea that it meant something that she'd stayed up here all day, that she'd watched the sun rise, cross the sky, and go back into the sea. She hadn't felt this rested in months, and those promises were looking better and better, like something she could own, keep, maybe even live for. She knew the feeling might not last, knew she might fall down again. But in this moment, Letty felt like the tallest thing on the island.
A note from Blake Crouch on Sunset Key. The idea for Sunset Key occurred to me in July of 2006, after reading a news story about the death of Kenneth Lay, the disgraced CEO of Enron Corporation. Lay was found guilty of securities fraud in May of 2006, and 3.5 months prior to his scheduled sentencing hearing, he died of a heart attack while on vacation in Snowmass, Colorado. He was expecting a 20 to 30 year prison sentence from the judge and would have likely died while incarcerated. Everything about the nature and timing of Lay's death intrigued me, but even more so the psychology of the man himself. Questions started to appear. What were Lay's thoughts during that vacation in Colorado, ostensibly his last days of freedom? Had his family deserted him or were they staying loyal? Did he experience remorse or continue to deceive himself when it came to his own guilt? How hard did he party? Did he eat amazing food and drink the best wine he could find? I had a feeling I would eventually write a story featuring such a character, but for the time being I set the idea aside. It didn't seem like enough to support a novel or a story. Several years passed. After I wrote The Pain of Others, I started brainstorming other potential Letty stories, looking for ways to continue her adventures. I remembered the news reports about Ken Lay and how they had stoked my imagination, and I decided to have Letty visit a man like Lay on his last night of freedom. An important note in terms of thinking about this story vis-a-vis Good Behavior, the television show. The Javier in Sunset Key is not the Javier in Good Behavior. The Javier in Sunset Key is a true psychopath. He only uses Letty and is fully willing to serve her up to John Fitch with the knowledge that she may be killed. The Javier in Good Behavior would never do this. The moment in the show when Javier turns around in Daphne Rochefort's bathroom and sees that Letty has the drop on him is a threshold moment for both of them. From that moment forward, they are intimately connected and will ultimately become each other's saviors. It was with this concern in mind that we made the decision not to include the story of Sunset Key in season 1 of Good Behavior. Javier's actions and motivations in this novella didn't track with the character we were setting up for the television show. Moreover, the tone of Sunset Key didn't quite fit with the tone of season 1. Sunset Key veers more into full-on suspense, especially in the latter half of the story, with Letty being hunted on the island. This is not to say that Sunset Key will never find its place in Good Behavior. If we're lucky enough to get a second season and can find the right way to dramatize Sunset Key while keeping within the tone of our show, then I still have hope this novella will have its day on screen.
Grab. 1. Letty Dobesh reached to freshen up a trucker's coffee from behind the counter. His name was Dale, or Dan, or Dave, something that started with a D. He was a regular, a creepy regular. Came into the diner several times a week, Tall, lanky, never-tipping guy who always wore a red down vest and a John Deere mesh hat. As Letty filled his mug, he grinned, said,
"Know what would look great on you? This should be good."
"No, what's that?" she asked without risking eye contact.
"Me?"
She did not meet his eyes. They were small and brown and contained a volatile energy that she recognized. He was a hitter.
"That's beautiful," she said. "You should write Hallmark cards."
The man laughed like he wasn't sure if he'd been insulted. Her manager called her name from the grill.
"Be there in a sec," she said.
"No, Letitia, not in a sec, now."
She set the pot of coffee back on the warmer and wiped her hands off on her apron. An image blindsided her. Letty at 70, hobbling around the diner on arthritic feet, hands like claws from a lifetime of this. The manager was a short, sweaty, unpleasant man. He wore black jeans, black sneakers, and a white Oxford shirt with a hideous Scooby-Doo tie. Same outfit, always. As she approached, she saw that he held a wire brush in his right hand. "Good morning, Lloyd."
"Bathrooms. They're disgusting. You were supposed to clean them yesterday."
"Lloyd, I haven't had a chance." He shoved the wire brush into her hand.
"With a smile."
"I'm smiling on the inside." Letty scrubbed furiously at a beard of dried shit affixed to the inside of the toilet. The noise of the jukebox was indistinct through the concrete walls, but a new refrain had taken up residence in her head. "This is my life. This is my life. This is my beautiful life." When the toilet bowl was pristine, she stood looking out of the small window behind the sink. The view was down Ocean Boulevard, vacation cottages and high-rises all oriented east toward the sea. There were bars over this small window, and Letty found it fitting. She'd been out of prison now almost 10 months, had been clean for half a year, but she hardly felt free. She was 36 years old, and she had just worked herself into a sweat, cleaning a toilet in a diner. Bad as prison had been, the walls that had kept her in her cell and in the yard had never screamed hopelessness as loud as the barred window in this tiny bathroom. In prison, there was always something to look forward to, the promise of release and, beyond, the possibility of a life different. She felt a sudden, irresistible urge to get high. "You don't do that anymore." "Why?" "For Jacob." She needed to distract herself. If she were back at the halfway house across the sound, she'd either jump in the shower or go for a run, do something to break that death spiral thought pattern. Here at work, she could just plug herself into serving the customers. Her therapist, Christian, would tell her to challenge the thought to use, to stop, take a moment, and analyze the error in it. "Where is the error? I feel bad. Getting high will make me feel good. Doesn't get much simpler than that. But it's not that simple, Letty, because you won't use once. If you start, you will use until you're broke, or dead, or back in prison." A layer of tears fluttered over the surface of her eyes. There was a knock at the door.
"Just a minute."
She wiped them away, smoothed her blue and white dress, pulled herself together. Lifting the cleaning supplies, she opened the door. The trucker in the John Deere hat stood in the alcove that accessed the men's and women's restrooms.
"All yours," she said.
He crowded into the doorway.
"Letitia, right?"
"That's right."
"Want to earn your tip? How about we go back in there for a spell?"
Letty pushed up against his scrawny, fetid frame. Reaching down, she grabbed his groin and pulled him toward her. He said,
"Oh, hell yeah."
Bulge in the vest, left side, wallet. With their lips an inch apart, Letty smiled. She released his manhood and drove her knee straight up into his balls at the same instant her right hand slid inside his vest, fingers diving into the pocket. She snatched the wallet as he keeled over onto the floor. Would have hit him again, but Lloyd had appeared at the end of the hallway that opened into the diner, his face twisted up with rage.
"You junkie whore! I didn't have to give a convicted felon a job. He was trying to— I don't care. You're fired. Get out."
Letty ripped off her apron and dropped it on the floor beside the moaning trucker, who'd gone fetal in the corner. She rode the bus into Charleston, sat in the back going through the trucker's wallet.
His name wasn't Dale, Dan, or Dave. It was Donald, and for a cheapskate, he carried around fat stacks, $420 in cash and 3 credit cards. She whipped out her jailbroken iPhone, which she'd retrofitted with a wireless card reader, started scanning Donald's Visa, MasterCard, and Amex, dumping sub-$100 deposits into shell accounts. 2. Letty put her hands behind her head and interlaced her fingers. She liked this couch. The leather was always warm. She liked the afternoon view through the open window in the back wall where the two blues met, sky and ocean. The air breezing through was tinged with salt and suntan lotion and the sweet rot of seaweed.
"You got fired?"
Christian said. He was seated at his desk several feet away. "This morning. I'm leaving town tonight. I've already cleared out my room at the halfway house. Won't miss that dump."
"I thought we agreed it would be a good idea for you to hold down that job at least through Christmas."
"I'm done with this place."
"Where will you go?"
"Oregon."
"To see your son?"
"That's the plan."
"Do you feel you're ready for that? Ready to re-enter Jacob's life on a permanent, reliable basis?"
"It's the only thing I'm living for, Christian."
"That means this is our last session."
"You've been great. The best part of my time here."
"Are you anxious?"
"About leaving?"
"It's a big deal."
"I know it is."
"How do you feel about it?"
"Ready."
"That's all?"
She stared at the Thriller-era Michael Jackson bobblehead on her substance abuse counselor's desk and said, "Christian, will it make you feel better if I say I'm scared?"
"Only if it's the truth."
"Of course I'm scared."
"Afraid you'll use again?"
"Sure."
"But you know how to fight it now. You're empowered. You know your triggers, external and internal. You know your 3 steps to ensure sobriety."
"Recognize, avoid, cope."
"There you go. And what's your main trigger?"
"Breathing."
"Come on."
"Remembering what a complete failure I am."
"That's not true."
"Convicted felon."
"Letty."
"Meth addict."
"Stop."
"Junkie whore."
"This is counter—"
"And let's not forget, you got Mother of the Year sitting on your couch. Christian, I got triggers everywhere I look." Christian leaned back in his chair and sighed the way he always did when Letty turned the knife on herself. He was old-school Hollywood handsome, Cary Grant, Gregory Peck. With his short-sleeved button-down and clip-on tie, he looked like a car salesman. But his eyes invited trust, kind and wise and sad. Could they be anything but, talking all day to losers like me?
"You know, if you don't make some kind of peace with yourself, Letty, none of this stuff works."
She let her eyes fall upon a painting on the wall beside Christian's desk, between 2 framed diplomas. She inevitably found herself staring at it during some point of each weekly session. It was a print of a romantic masterpiece, a man standing in a dark frock coat on the edge of a cliff. His back is to the viewer, and he's gazing out over a barren, fog-swept waste. The landscape looks so hostile and unforgiving it could be another planet. Christian turned in his swivel chair and glanced up at the wall.
"You like that painting?"
"What's it called?"
"Wanderer Above the Sea of Fog."
"Nice."
"What do you like about it?"
"I like the man's fear."
"Why do you say he's afraid? You can't even see his face. I think he's exhilarated."
"No, he's afraid. We all are, and this painting says that. It says we're not alone."
"You're not alone, Letty. If you'd take my advice and join a group, you'd see that."
"NA isn't for me."
"Sobriety is a group effort."
"Christian, the only time I never used was when I was working, when I had a job."
"You mean stealing?"
"Yeah."
"You still messing around with that?"
She smiled. "You know what they say? You can take the girl out of prison."
"That's just another form of addiction, Letty."
"I get that."
"So what are you saying?"
"I want to stay clean. For me, for my son. But I don't see the world like you do."
"What do you see?"
Her lips curled up into something that could almost be called a smile. She pointed at the painting. 3. Letty left town that evening with her entire life, such as it was, in a suitcase. Clothes, A framed photograph of Jacob at 4 years old, smiling from the top of a slide. Laptop, phone, and $5,000 in cash. With a thermos full of French roast, she drove all night, slept at a truck stop in Arkansas the next day. She got off the interstate where she could and stuck to back roads, something more therapeutic in driving her Honda Civic Beater down a two-lane highway than anything she'd experienced in rehab, a tangible sense of the life before falling behind her like so many miles of faded yellow stripes. She didn't push herself. Some days she only clocked 100 miles. Oregon was the final destination, but she made no effort to take a direct course. She meandered and, in the beginning, didn't think about a thing, just let the landscape scroll. Whole chunks of time when her mind was a bright blue, cloudless sky, when she was so completely out of herself that when she snapped back into the moment, she couldn't even remember driving. She'd be in a new state, on a different road. She wanted more time to pass like that. She lived so rarely in the present, her existence neatly boiled down into two equal parts. The depression and regret of her past, the fear of what was to come. Her two planes of consciousness. Or was it planes? And she was driving on the plains of eastern Nebraska on a late summer afternoon when something like an epiphany struck her. She would always remember the moment because out the windshield, her stretch of prairie was sun-drenched and golden with late light. When I'm high and when I'm on a job, I'm not plagued by the sadness of the past or the fear of the future. That's why I use, why I steal. Those are the only times when I live in the moment like a free human being. She checked into a motel in the eastern desert of New Mexico on her 5th or 6th day. It was after 10 p.m., and in the west the sky was getting raked by an electrical storm that was too far out for the sound of its thunder to reach her. She pulled a chair out onto the concrete balcony, sat watching the sky light up, thinking how nice it would be to get high. It wasn't much of a desert town, but she'd driven past a roadhouse on the outskirts. She could take a shower, put on something slinky, head down there and score. She could almost taste the smoke. Gasoline and plastic and household cleaners and Sharpies and sometimes apples. Oh yes, and nail polish. She hadn't dared to paint her toes in the last 6 months for fear the odor alone would set her down the bad path. Challenge the thought to use. You do it tonight, when you start to come down, you'll feel so bad you'll have to go again, and again, cycle repeats. Then you'll have lived in this motel room for 3 weeks and eaten nothing but convenience store food. You'll be frail and sick, right back where you were last fall. But the urge was still there. So how do you cope? If she went back into the room, she knew what would happen. She'd take a shower under the guise of distracting herself, but then she'd get out, suitcase dive for something sexy, and head down to the bar. So how do you cope? Stay right where you are. Do not move. By midnight, she could hear the thunder and smell the threat of rain in the sky like a closed-up attic. She didn't go inside, not even when the rain started. It came down in curtains. The temperature fell. Almost instantly, there were pools of standing water in the empty parking lot. The lightning touched the desert a quarter mile away, and the ensuing noise was louder than a shotgun blast at close range. Still, she didn't move. Her clothes were drenched, and she was shivering. The storm passed. Stars appeared. She could hear the quiet roar of I-40 a mile away. It was 3:30 in the morning. Struggling to her feet, she pulled open the sliding glass door and walked into the frigid air conditioning. She stripped out of her wet clothes and climbed naked into bed. The need was still there, just no longer screaming in her face. Now she pictured it as the embodiment of an emaciated woman crouched in a corner, whispering madly to herself. 4. She stopped the next afternoon in the red desert waste of Arizona. It had been 24 hours since she'd eaten, something in the ache of an empty stomach that she found useful in fighting the urge to use. If hunger was on her mind, crystal meth wasn't. But now she was dizzy and lightheaded, feared her driving was on the cusp of becoming erratic.
She got off the interstate past Winslow and headed south through a landscape of buttes and exposed rock, a world stripped down to its bones. She felt so lightheaded it was becoming difficult to focus, but a quick glance in the rearview mirror cut through the fog. The black tundra that had been trailing her for the last 100 miles, perhaps more, had taken the same exit. Am I being paranoid because I'm famished? She pulled into the visitor center, walked up to the drab brick building and paid the admission fee. Inside, the air conditioning was set to blizzard. She pretended to peruse the gift shop card rack while she stared out the window that overlooked the parking lot. The driver's side door of the tundra was open. A black man climbed out. He wore khaki shorts and a white t-shirt without a logo or slogan. Letty threaded her way through the tourists and slipped out the exit. She followed the observation path through the desert until she stood on the rim. The depression was gaping, nearly a mile across, 500 feet deep. She could see people the size of ants on the far side, walking the trail that circled the crater. The heat radiating off the ground was tremendous. A hole in the ground. Yay. Turning, she studied the visitor center. No sign of the black man from the tundra. You're imagining things. Go eat something. She ordered a foot-long veggie sandwich at the Subway in the visitor center and claimed a booth. Crazy hungry. Didn't even come up for air until she was halfway through and nearly choked when she did, because that man was sitting across from her, smiling. It was a beautiful smile, broad and bright. But there was something malicious and knowing in it that she couldn't quite put her finger on, like the man wasn't smiling at her, but rather at something he knew about her. Letty put her sandwich down, wiped her mouth. By all means, she said, please join me. The man unwrapped his sandwich, a meatball sub, and dug in. You followed me here, Letty said. He nodded as he chewed. Through a mouthful, he said,
picked you up in Gallup.
What do you mean, picked me up? He just smiled. There's something I can help you with? She asked.
Damn, girl. Can I eat my sub first?
They ate in silence, watching each other. He was 30-something, Letty figured, but closing in on 40. Her age, possibly. No trace of stubble. Brown eyes. Movie star handsome. Shredded. They finished their sandwiches without a word, and then he washed his down with a long hit of Coke through a straw that sucked his cheeks in. He said,
ah, can't believe they had a Subway. That's just a bonus. You look thoughtful. Let me guess, you going through all the people you ever wronged, trying to figure out who's come back to settle the score, yeah?
Letty made no acknowledgement, but he was right.
This ain't about none of that, he said. Ain't here to hurt you. This got nothing to do with anything in your past. All about the future.
That unnerving smile again. Letty drew in a long breath. Her head was clear now, and she was afraid. How'd you find me?
Friend of mine in Charleston put a trim track on your ride. Know what that is?
She shook her head.
Little device that lets me track your location using GPS. I heard you was coming west. Thought we should meet.
Why?
We'll get to that.
I have a phone. Just calling would have been less creepy than this by a factor of 100.
I'm more persuasive in person.
Have we met before?
No, but we share a friend.
Who's that?
My man, Hav.
Javier sent you after me?
Not after you. To you. With a proposal.
I hope you weren't counting on Javier's name to facilitate whatever the hell you thought was going to happen here. He reached his hand across the table.
Isaiah.
She didn't take it.
Damn, that's cold.
I want you to get your tracking device off my car and leave me alone.
Why you hating when you ain't even heard what-
Does Javier want something? Is that what this is about?
No, I want something.
I don't understand.
He recommended you to me.
For what? He grinned.
What do you think? A job.
Letty leaned back against the seat.
I did some work with Hav last fall,
Isaiah said.
He's an interesting-
He's a psychopath.
Be that as it may, he knows a lot of people. I called him last week, told him about this thing I got going, this bind I'm in. told him the kind of person, kind of skill set I needed, and he said I had to have you.
No, I'm done with all that. Even as she said it, she tasted the lie. Do you know why I'm driving across the country, Isaiah?
No.
To see my son.
For real?
For real.
And what, you ain't seen him in a while?
She shook her head.
What happened?
Right. I'm going to tell the guy who's been spying on me for the last week about my private affairs.
You ain't gotta be this way, Letitia. I ain't coming at you with negativity.
She sighed. What do you want?
Javier tells me you the best.
The best what?
Best liar he's ever worked with.
Thanks, I guess.
And that you got scary fast hands.
So?
So that's exactly what I need.
I think I already gave you my answer.
You don't even want the pitch?
Nope.
So you out, huh? Gonna go be Miss Respectable Citizen? Get a 9-to-5? Pay taxes? All that shit?
I'm gonna go be a mother to my son. Isaiah's eyes didn't exactly soften, but his body language changed, like someone had let a little air out of the tires.
That's cool, then. I feel that.
He crumpled up his Subway wrapper, slid out of the booth.
Good luck to you, Letitia.
You too, Isaiah. Hope the score's big and you don't get caught. His laugh was low, booming.
Never.
She watched him walk out of the restaurant, felt suddenly cold, alone and empty and void of anything approaching hope. Here it came, right on cue, the crushing need to use. Challenge the thought. When I'm high and when I'm on a job, those are the only times in my life not plagued by the sadness of the past or the fear of the future. So, tonight, you can either be high in some motel room, taking that first step toward running your life into the ground once again, or... 5. Letty caught Isaiah in the parking lot, crouched down beside her car, prying the tracking device off the undercarriage. He looked up, grinning. She said, I was thinking.
Yeah?
You want to walk around the crater? It was god-awful hot, Letty already sweating. Isaiah moved slowly along the footpath. They had to keep stopping to let the tour group up ahead gain distance.
Ever hear of a man named Richter?
He asked. What thief hasn't? The rock star grifter we all want to be. But he's just a myth, urban legend.
Actually, he's not.
You've met him?
I'm doing a job with him.
Letty felt a pulse of energy ride up the bones of her legs into her stomach, like it had come from the ground beneath her feet. Where's the job?
4.5 hours from where you stand.
She stopped, shielded her eyes from the sun as she stared up at him. He was smiling, but his eyes were hidden behind a pair of aviator sunglasses. Vegas?
Fabulous Las Vegas.
She said, a man I respect very much once told me that of all the jobs in the world, the only one I should never touch was a casino. Said, there's all this money floating around waiting for us to just reach up and grab it. Why rob it from the pit of hell? They walked again.
I'm part of Richter's 10-man crew,
Isaiah said. What's your superpower?
Brute force? Weapons? I was force recon back in the day. So the vault in one of the major casinos is having its security system overhauled this coming weekend. We don't know if it's Friday, Saturday, or Sunday.
I'm not going into any goddamn vault, I'll just tell you that right now.
Me and you both, sister. Here's the cool part. They don't trust nobody, not even the security company personnel. 2 hours before the install, they box the cash up and cart it from the vault area into a room in the hotel. Of course, the money is still guarded by its own private army, but at least there's no vault to break it out of.
And what, Richter has a guy on the inside?
Exactly. At some point on Friday, 24 to 36 hours from now, Richter will get a call or a text from his contact. They'll tell him when the security install is happening and which room in the hotel will be housing all that cash. Richter's plan is ingenious. The crew gains access to the room directly underneath. We go through the ceiling, set up an ambush, and let the money come to us.
You have blueprints of the hotel?
No. Too many variables and possibilities. We'll have to finalize our game plan once we see the room they've chosen.
Sounds super risky.
For sure. But the probability of success is much greater than if we had to go through a vault, grab the cash, and fight our way back out through the casino. No amount of money could get me to sign up for that shit.
I guess I'm just confused. I mean, the idea of working with Richter sounds intriguing, but I'm having a hard time seeing where I fit into all of this. Your plan sounds solid. What do you need me for?
I've said you could be trusted.
I can.
You wouldn't be working with Richter.
I don't understand.
Richter put the crew together, but he's doing one thing in this whole deal. He's given us the room number and the time. It's his contact at the hotel. I give him that. But he ain't gonna be anywhere near the hotel room when the half-dozen armed guards roll in with the money.
His contact, his show, right?
He's taking half. Other 9 of us are splitting the rest. And it's like we should be grateful for the privilege. That sound right to you?
Not so much.
So I'm thinking, sure, Richter's a legend, but fuck him.
How exactly?
I'm running a shadow crew. Brought in Jared and Stu, 2 of my boys from Iraq. We're gonna take down this money. Estimate is 38 to 40 mil. Split that 4 ways, including you, we're taking possibly 7 zeros apiece. You know what I call that?
No, what do you call that?
I call that, you ain't gotta do shit ever again, money. I call that living right for the rest of your life, money. Don't tell me some part of you hasn't always dreamed of robbing a casino.
She was starting to see it, her place in this madness. They had walked half a mile, and she was dripping with sweat. She looked back at the visitor center. Richter's phone, she said. You want me to grab it. That's why you want me, right? Isaiah grinned.
Among other things.
What other things?
Whatever we need, but nothing you can't handle. And if you ain't down for that, I'm happy to pay you a flat rate for the grab. But if you want to be in on the split, you see this thing through to the end.
I don't do jobs that require guns, she said, not for any amount of money.
Well, I guess it's your lucky day.
No guns? Seriously?
No guns for the takedown. Too noisy, too messy. But if things turn to shit after, I make no promises. If you need to think it over, I can give you 1 hour. But the clock is ticking.
No.
No?
I don't need to think it over. 6. Letty rolled down Las Vegas Boulevard at sunset, the strip already aglow. It had been 5 years since her last visit, and she was happy to see that everything about this city still got under her skin in the best kind of way. Where most people saw absurdity and flash, she saw art and life and possibility. There was the Venetian, lit up like a white angel. The MGM Grand, the color of money, or the guy at the blackjack table losing his shirt while everyone around him wins. She loved the universal hustle. The bellboys, the strippers, the hookers, the dealers, the doormen, the bartenders, everyone angling. She could live here. Isaiah had checked her into a prestige suite at the Palazzo. After a week of Motel 6s and worse, this elevation into luxury made her exuberant. She ordered up room service, then headed downstairs to find an outfit for the evening with the envelope of hundos that Isaiah had provided as a starting expense account. She bought a dress at Chloe, pumps at Christian Louboutin, had a makeover at a salon called Fresh. By 10 o'clock, she looked like a completely different creature. The 7-day accumulation of road grunge gone. She stood at the window in the living room of her suite, looking down at the traffic moving along Sands Avenue, 28 floors below. Across the street, she had a perfect view of their ultimate target, the sleek curve of the Wynn. But tonight wasn't about money or a vault. Tonight was all on her. Richter and his crew would be at Tryst at 11 p.m. A knock at her door pulled her away from the window. Through the peephole, she saw a bellboy. Opened the door. I have a package for you, ma'am. She took the small box and gave him a 5-spot. Letty carried it into the kitchen. It resembled an expensive gift box. Simple, elegant, gold paper. Her phone rang as she tugged off the white ribbon and tore at the wrapping paper. Hello?
Get my package?
You really shouldn't have. She lifted the top off the box, a black iPhone and a photograph. The photo was a headshot of a white man with a shaven head and a few days' worth of stubble darkening his jawline. For some reason, the smooth head and intense eyes reminded Letty of a thug in a European heist flick. Otherwise, he was unremarkable, nothing like how she'd imagined the legend. Then again, maybe that was the point. Isaiah said,
I'll need access to Richter's phone for 1 hour. This is his replacement.
Does it work?
No. It was impossible for Mark to replicate his contact list, apps, texts, call history. Say for Play to swap it for a non-functioning phone. It'll power up and display a black screen. What I'm asking isn't easy. I need you to swap his current phone out for this one. Then you're going to have to hand off his phone to my contact at the club. He'll find you, so don't worry about that. Then you have to entertain Richter for 1 hour while my guy builds the clone. Then you have to switch his real phone back for the fake.
She said, what if he freaks when his phone doesn't work?
If he's into you, maybe he doesn't even think about his phone for 1 hour.
This is a tall order, she said, just so you know.
Tall orders come with big paydays. You got this, Letitia?
Yeah, and by the way, it's Letty. I go by Letty.
Aight. Since we turnin' into homies, I go by Eyes.
See you in the club, Eyes. 7. Even at 10:30, the line to get into Tryst was ridiculous. Letty was pretty sure she looked fabulous, but in the back of her mind, her age kept popping. 15 years older than almost everyone around. She didn't look 36, at least not tonight. Could have possibly passed for something that started with a 2, depending on the lighting, but still. The group ahead of her consisted of 2 couples. One of the guys was trying to talk to a doorman in black slacks and a muscle tee with the cold eyes of an assassin. A man who had heard every plea to get inside. He was flipping pages on a clipboard and shaking his head.
I don't see you on anybody's guest list, and just to be straight up with you, there's no way you're going inside wearing sandals and shorts.
Are you kidding me?
Do I look like I'm kidding you? Go put on some adult clothes and try again.
This is bullshit. The doorman looked past the group, met eyes with Letty. She pushed her way through to the velvet rope. How's your night going? She asked.
No complaints. What's your name?
I'm not on anybody's guest list.
We're pretty full tonight.
How about I just give you $100? She already had it in her hand. The doorman looked down, took it, opened the velvet rope. She tried not to let it eat at her as she moved through the lounge area toward the entrance, the house music beginning to build. She'd had to slide a bribe to get in. Couldn't deny it. It stung. The lounge was a spread of reserved tables and clusters of beautiful people. She opened her purse, checked her phone. A new text from Isaiah. North patio by the waterfall. She paid her cover charge and entered the club. The place was mobbed and loud beyond any level of pleasure she could conceive of. Straight on, the DJ booth was manned by a clean-cut white kid whose day job you would never suspect outside these walls. Behind it, a waterfall crashed into a lake. Paths branched off the dance floor, one leading toward the main bar, the other to what she guessed was a VIP lounge. The decor and vibe felt seedy, dark, and elegant all at once. The strobe was disorienting, the heat on the dance floor massive. As she skirted through, 2 men caught her eyes and tried to lure her in. The air redolent of alcohol, cologne, sweat. She fought her way to the doors leading out onto the north patio. Despite it being summertime in the desert, it was cooler outside the crush of pheromones. The pool teemed with schools of bikini-clad women and ripped men, the stimulation dizzying. She wanted a drink, a hit of Crystal. It was the most beautiful nightclub she'd ever seen, and to be here carefree and high would have been exhilarating. To be here on a job, she had to admit, was a close second. Even outside, there was no place to sit, every table either filled or reserved. She spotted Isaiah standing near a table in the far corner, tucked in beside the waterfall. He was laughing, and he looked good. Designer blue jeans, red wing boots, black tee under a green velvet bomber jacket. He stood with 4 other men, far outnumbered by the entourage of women surrounding them. It took Letty several minutes to make her way through the crowd to the outskirts of Isaiah's table. She stood alone. So much movement, so much conversation all around her. Lanterns hung from the trees, and she could just hear the white noise of the falling water. 9 hours ago, she'd been talking to Isaiah at the crater. Seemed like years ago. A train wreck of a thought barreled through her mind. There are so many women here more beautiful than you. Richter is surrounded by them. Why would he give you the time of day? Why should he? You look out of place here. You had to pay extra just to get inside. Stop. Maybe challenging the thought works on a job, too. Quit being insecure. This isn't the hardest thing you've ever done. You know how to make people like you. I need a drink. No, you don't. Yes, I do. She let the stimulation overwhelm her. The smell of champagne like spring in the air. The starless Vegas sky. The voluptuous architecture of the wind. The bright blue of the pool and the yellow glow behind the 90-foot waterfall. The red heat inside the club. The infectious groove as the DJ remixed a song she liked. Cowboy Junkies covering Ooh Las Vegas. Everyone around her was moving. She let her hips begin to sway. Everyone was here to have fun, and so was she. So was Richter. She had this. Letty moved closer to their table. There, talking to one of the orbiting women who looked just bimbo enough to possibly be an escort. Richter was shorter than she'd imagined, barely 5'10". He wasn't handsome, just put together nicely. Retro glasses, a short-sleeved button-down that seemed to shimmer, no belt, shiny black wingtips, no jacket. In that case, she'd be mining the front pockets of his slacks. Back pocket would be better, cargo pants ideal, but front pocket was workable, and his pants didn't look too tight. In fact, it was more in her comfort zone than a grab from an inner jacket pocket. A pants pocket was a pocket. What you saw was what you got, with tightness being the only variable. An inner jacket pocket that you couldn't see was full of surprises, like zippers, snaps, buttons, all manner of things to snag probing fingers. She could feel her adrenaline begin to spike as she approached. She drew within range of Richter and the bimbo. The woman stood on legs that looked too insubstantial to support her top half. Richter was staring at her with a glazed look that Letty hoped was boredom. She inched closer, overheard the bimbo shouting,
"Yeah, I've been out here about a year and a half. It's pretty fun, you know, lots to do. Sometimes I wake up and it's like, I live in Vegas, right? Like, oh my God."
Letty looked up at Richter. Eye contact. He said,
"And what's this? Another fly come to suck off our bottle service?"
He turned away from both women, called out,
"Gentlemen, let's roll."
Letty shoved down the flush of rage. Do not let him leave. But she couldn't think of a single play to stop this from happening. Bimbo said, "Asshole," and stormed off. Richter and the rest of his crew headed out, with Isaiah bringing up the rear. He didn't even look at her. 8. Letty's feet were killing her. She eased down into one of the chairs at the empty table. Steaming. In shock. She'd choked. Her first job since last Christmas, and she'd blown it. A promoter materialized, cute brunette with chopped hair, amazing dress. Name tag read Jessica. She smiled at Letty and knelt down so she didn't have to shout.
"Hi, what's your name?"
Letty said, "Gidget."
"Well, Gidget, this is actually a reserve table. I have a group I need to put here."
Screams from the next table over drew Letty's attention. Looked like a bachelorette party unfolding. Pure, smashed joy. Letty slid back into her pumps, struggled onto her feet. "All yours." Letty headed back toward the dance floor, just wanting to get out of the noise, out of the movement. Inside, it was, impossibly, more crowded than before. A wall of bodies, the music ear-rupturing, the bass heart-stopping. She moved along the perimeter. A group of three guys at a table called out to her with Boston accents. They were working their way through a 1.75-liter bottle of Jack, and they reeked of desperation. Any other night, she'd have had a drink and grabbed their wallets. It took her 5 minutes to push through the crowd and past the entrance into the front lounge, the barrage of self-destructive thoughts firing away. You've lost it.
You're washed up. Then she was passing a line of nightclub hopefuls that snaked through the lobby of the Wynn. Then she was outside, sucking down gulps of exhaust-tinged desert air. She kicked off her shoes and carried them, her head swirling. She felt her phone vibrate, opened her purse. A text from Isaiah. What the fuck was that? Good question. She hit him back. Location? He answered, stand down, see you tomorrow. She went up to her room, but she couldn't calm down, couldn't stand the thought of lying in bed playing her epic fail over and over again. She needed to score. Challenge the thought. I need to get high. Challenge the thought. Think about your son. Think about, I need to get high. She wound up at the Zebra Lounge, a bar in her hotel with tons of seating upholstered in zebra print. On stage, dueling pianists played something fast and obnoxious. She sat at the bar, hadn't had a drink since starting rehab in Charleston, and she wanted to fall off the wagon with something big and noisy. While the bartender made her Long Island iced tea, she studied him, trying to get a read on whether he would further her ultimate ambitions for the evening. He was 23 or 24, smooth-shaven, cropped hair, lifted weights for sure. No tats that she could see, although he wore a long-sleeved black button-down, which didn't reveal much. He set her drink in front of her, said, $17, start a tab? Sure, put it on my room. She gave him the number. What's your name, by the way?
Darren.
Darren, if I wanted to get my hands on something a little stronger than booze, would you be able to point me in the right direction? She could see in his eyes that he got asked this all the time.
Talk to Jay at Japanese in the Mirage. He's working tonight.
Appreciate that. He left her to her drink. It was strong and very good. Yes, the night had blown up to this moment, but she was about to turn it around. Letty leaned over her drink and sucked the rest of it down. The liquor hit her gut in a burst of beautiful heat. 9. Letty crossed the boulevard. The strip at midnight, sleepless and blinking and radiating a nervous energy that filled her junky soul with the closest thing to joy she could ever hope to know. Even at this hour, too much traffic creeping between the median of palm trees. Almost everyone she passed was lit up. Hell, she was too. It felt good to be outside again, walking and buzzed and the Mojave air skirting over her shoulders between her knees. Surreal to be in the midst of all this stimulation and to know that 20 miles in any direction would put you in abject emptiness. Between Treasure Island and the Mirage, a small black man